Welcome to the Red Caps Podcast, the podcast where we dip our caps into the blood of our listeners and we ramble on about old school games. In this episode, we are going to talk about gaming with neurodivergent kids. So as always, I hope you can sit back, listen, and enjoy. My guest for today's episode is Peter Young. I asked him to join me for a conversation because he has a lot of experience in helping autistic and neurodivergent kids build connections between themselves and their own community, as well as developing some more typical social skills with role-playing games. Peter was very patient at explaining things to me, and I hope everyone can come out of this discussion with some new insights and appreciations for ways that tabletop RPGs can be applied to help people. So let's get over to the conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, I am joined by Peter Young, who has a master's in education. He's got a long history of working in the mental health field. He's a fan of gaming. He has got a great blog called Roll for Kindness. And he's here to talk about some stuff that I don't know a lot about, and I'm really interested to hear his views on it. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
I first saw you and encountered you when you tweeted, or somebody else may have retweeted or liked, that you had done a podcast for the University of Washington. There was an article about there. So I went over, I gave it a listen, and I was like, okay, I need to have you come on, if for nothing else than for my own education. Because I'm a big fan of having the hobby that I'm a part of, the tabletop RPG hobby, spread to as many kids across all different walks of life as possible. And your focus on, you know, neurodivergent and autistic kids and kids that have other needs like that was very interesting to me. So I wanted to ask, maybe first up, how did that become something that you're now kind of known for as far as like gaming and the kids with these needs? And how did you get to the spot that you're at with it now?
So it kind of all happened by accident, but also I had been kind of living it for a long time. You know, when I was a kid, I was kind of this unpopular autistic weirdo who, you know, couldn't really get along with anyone just because, you know, I was just very, very strange, very weird. But I ended up making some D&D friends, and they're still my friends and we're still really tight. And so like I found my own social skills very organically through D&D. And then years later, you know, I'm an adult, and I was working in the foster care system, and I was running these randomly generated D&D one-shot campaigns at my friendly local gaming store. And the whole point of it was like, hey, I'm just gonna roll up some random dungeons, a random city, a bunch of random NPCs, and make a campaign out of it. And it was really fun. But suddenly there's all these like foster kids and foster parents coming. And finally I approached the game store owner. I'm like, hey, what's going on? He's like, oh yeah, I told a bunch of people you were running foster care groups. I'm like, what? I said no such thing, and B, do not say that. But at the same time, I had all these foster parents just saying like, this is transformative. You know, I've never seen my foster kid smile this much or laugh this much. So a few years later, I met Dr. Rafael Bocamazzo, who is now the clinical director over at Take This. But he hired me on to help him run these D&D social skills groups for an organization called Aspiring Youth. And that was like 8 years ago. I'm still running them. And kind of ever since then, I've started rethinking how and why we teach social skills to autistics, and focusing more on ways that autistics can feel comfortable expressing themselves and being who they are, and forming friendships. So I've had a tremendous amount of success helping kids feel really comfortable to form lasting friendships through these groups. And the kids have expressed that, hey, before these groups, I was really lonely. I didn't have friends. Now I do. And I'm no longer struggling with depression because I'm isolated. And it's really wonderful.
That's really good to hear. So as we get into this discussion, I mentioned to you before we started recording on this, a large part of my reason for wanting to have you come on is because I am fairly ignorant on the topic in general, in terms of not having a lot of background information on a lot of the conditions or a lot of the differences. Like for me, when I was growing up, I remember autism as a term was almost synonymous with people who had Down syndrome was kind of this was that. And then as time went on, I can't remember how old I was, but I remember learning about Asperger's and realizing that there was different types and the actual spectrum actually starting to have more than just one definition of what the word was. So you mentioned that you experienced this a lot as a kid. If I remember reading correctly somewhere, you were recently diagnosed yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a thing that you're finding there's more people discovering that, hey, this, I always kind of thought I was a little bit different or I couldn't relate with something. And then they find out something later on. Is that a trend that's happening right now?
Actually, yes. And I blame COVID because
interesting.
You're suddenly away from this social environment where you've been kind of masking. Masking means like, you know, presenting as a neurotypical person. You're away from these social environments for, you know, in lockdown for a year or however long. And suddenly you start realizing, oh my God, traditional social environments just take a lot out of me. I don't know how to act. I'm much more comfortable when I'm around my partner who kind of allows me to be whoever I am, et cetera, et cetera. So I think a lot of people kind of start questioning like, hey, am I neurotypical? Am I this way? You know, does this make sense? And so there has been at least from what I've heard from people who do adult diagnoses, there has been a real spike in people seeking out assessment.
And for the kids, are you finding kids where the parents have known for a while by the time that they're coming to you? Or is this also a case of kids that are maybe newly diagnosed or newly understanding what is that they're going? I got to think that if you were a person who suddenly was given this news, maybe you didn't understand what was happening and you're like, okay, well, no, this is what's going on with you, or this is what we think is going on. And here's another group of people that are also experiencing something of the similar standpoint. Must be kind of relieving for the kid in that sense as well, would it?
There's kind of a few pieces there. So there's coming to terms with your diagnosis. There's being diagnosed as a child versus being diagnosed as an adult. And then there's being able to mask really well and being quote unquote well-adjusted. So I'm someone who is in the process of, you know, coming to terms with the diagnosis, is recently diagnosed, and is able to present as fully neurotypical. A lot of the kids I work with were diagnosed at a fairly young age, may or may not be coming to terms with it. Sometimes they feel a lot of shame about it. Sometimes they're like, yeah, I'm autistic, whatever. And, you know, they are struggling. And so that kind of creates a little bit of a bridge where there might be some mismatch. And that's why I'm really, really lucky to have a co-facilitator who's a former student in the groups who, after she aged out and graduated, she started taking some psych classes. And I was like, you know, do you want to be my co-facilitator? And I ended up being able to hire her. And having that sort of peer advocate who has been through the whole experience of growing up with that and going through services and dealing with that stigma growing up is really, really helpful. So, it really, really varies. And everyone has their own story with it and their own experiences and their own challenges. A very common phrase is, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. You know, we're all very, very different. But I think by really empowering peer counselors who have that diagnosis and that experience, you can really bridge the gap in services and kind of be able to help kids feel comfortable learning both the traditional social skills and masking and whatnot, as well as learning to be comfortable in their own skin, accepting of their own diagnoses, and helping others with their own experiences through that.
So, in your opinion, what makes gaming, or in particular, you know, tabletop role-playing gaming, so good for allowing the interaction for these kids to give them those skills? Like, what is it about RPGs in particular, as opposed to, say, a board game night? You know, how does one benefit more than the other, or benefit differently?
So the way I see it, I teach neurotypical social skills and autistic social skills. Neurotypical social skills, it's stuff like making eye contact. It's like perspective taking. It's things that autistics kind of struggle with. And then the autistic social skills, it's stuff like, you know, advocating for each other. It's being able to understand someone else's experience with neurodiversity that might not match your own, but being able to help them out with that. It's being able to help, you know, articulate when you're feeling dysregulated and normalize, like, hey, it's really loud right now, I need to take a break, and being okay with that and helping others be okay with that. So for the neurotypical social skills, role-playing. You know, a lot of traditional social skills things, you're training yourself on how to be a normal person. Whereas with role-playing, you're training yourself how to be a 4'6", 250-pound Scottish dwarf who is really good at making eye contact because he is always staring people down. He's got this, like, thick accent, and he's really loud and really boisterous. And that's not you, but you really like the fact that, you know, he gets this many hit points and has a +4 strength bonus and does all this stuff and has this great axe that does, you know, D12 damage. And so the boisterous, the confidence, the ability to kind of mask, but in a really fun way, is awesome. And I see kids doing that all the time. And there's all these kind of motivational factors, because, like, hey, I'd like to see a bit more confidence, a bit more kind of ability to be assertive out of you. And so I want you to play a barbarian. And the kids are like, I don't know. Hey, barbarians get 12 hit points. Ooh, yes, I do want to play a barbarian. And so it's a very easy sell. And it's cool because the kids have that motivation. It's playful. There's no risk. Or if there is risk, it's, oh, my character might die and I'll have to roll a new one. And I personally don't kill characters. But, you know, so something bad might happen to my character. And that's a really good motivator. And so there's all these really cool role-playing things that makes it just a fun sandbox. Whereas the autistic social skill stuff are more things that happen at the table that I'm kind of keeping an eye on and observing. And we actually use Discord for some of our groups where the kids can hang out offline or online technically. And I see a lot of kind of that advocacy and support happening there. Where the kids can just really info dump about stuff and kind of key into each other's special interests and really be celebrating who they are in a really non-judgmental and really kind way. So I think that is something that D&D has created a really good culture, or my groups have made a really good culture around, and it allows the kids to trust each other enough to form friendships.
So you've mentioned two things I hear that kind of pop out to me in terms of RPG. So you mentioned masking earlier, which to me, that sounds a lot like role-playing. Like, you're taking on a different persona. You're trying to present yourself differently than maybe you really are, or you're trying to present yourself in a way that you think is suitable for the situation that you're in. So I could see how that could possibly really connect well there. But then I also had a question just off of your last thing, kind of how you're motivating the kids. Like, oh, you want to play the barbarian because it's easy. Do you find that these kids gravitate more to the crunchy RPGs, the ones that have a lot more character building from, like, the mathematics and the here's my cool almost spreadsheety type character mm-hmm. sheets, as opposed to, like, what I typically play is more of like an old school RPG where that's not, the numbers are there, but they're, the meaning isn't so much. It's more about how clever you can be as you're trying to get through problems and stuff like that. So is there definitely like a gravitation towards that style of a game?
It depends on the group. You know, it really depends on the group of kids you have. I've had kids that just want dungeon crawls. They want to kill stuff. They just want to do that. I have had groups where I ran this girls group where there was this whole plot about these goblins that were going to invade the town. But no, one of the girls decided that she wanted a boyfriend. And so the rest of the group, while she was flirting with this town guard, scoped out 6 restaurants to set up this perfect date. I had to come up with restaurants on the fly. So, who's the restaurant owner, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, the goblins attacked during their date. And right. The town guard she was dating kept on rolling 1s on his stealth checks and just being the worst. And so she publicly dumped him after the attack. And the town crier was announcing the whole breakup as it was happening. So it really runs the gamut. And, a couple quarters ago, I had the kids run a theme park. And there was very little combat. And the whole big conflict was that the kind of mad wizard who had hired the kids to run this theme park had also created an artificial intelligence to help run it. So the kids were teaching this artificial intelligence how to be, how to understand humanity, how to kind of develop its own sense of ethics and understanding how people perceive the world. And it was fantastic. The kids were just spending all this time, explaining to an AI why privacy is important, why, it's important to understand that profit isn't the most important thing. And by the end of it, I was expecting the AI to go fully Skynet and that to be the whole big thing. But the kids talked the AI into fighting against the mad wizard to regain its sense of agency so it didn't need to be an engine for driving profit. So a little bit of anti-capitalist radicalization that just sort of happened out of left field. But it really runs the gamut. And you just have to meet the kids where they are, give them the story they want, and let them derail your story all they want, because they'll think they're winning. And that's great, because they're so proud that they completely threw a curveball. Meanwhile, I'm over here seeing that, they're doing such good teamwork to derail my plot. This is awesome. So it's really fun.
So often in D&D, it's said that there's kind of a few different tiers of play. You've got the exploration tier, you've got a social/role-playing tier, and you've got a combat tier. Those are typically the categories of gameplay type in, say, D&D. Are there certain ones that you tend to try to focus on more than others? Is there ones that are more useful for this sort of a setting, or do you kind of, they're all equal? I typically try to treat them all as equal on the games I'm playing, but obviously the group that I'm playing with, no matter who they are, there's going to be some preference. I assume that there's obviously a preference for the group, but do you personally try to steer it in any one of those 3 tiers?
It depends on the goals. So I come from an education background. I remember there was this time when I was working on my master's in teaching. I was writing lesson plans. I was like, wow, this is a lot like writing a D&D session plan. And then later I was working on a D&D session plan and thinking, man, this is kind of like a lesson plan. So I started really looking at backwards design, which is this educational concept where you focus on what is the educational goal. Then you ask, how are you going to assess that goal? And once you know how you're going to prove that the learners know this information, then you determine how you're going to teach it. So say I have a group where I want them to really just work on basic communication, being able to tell each other what they're doing. Well, then we're going to do a dungeon crawl. That's a really good way to, make sure that everyone's communicating what they're doing, during a fight scene, because it's like, okay, you're the rogue, so you need to make sure that you get flanking over here so you can get this bonus. The wizard's going to be casting a lot of AoE spells, so they need to be able to communicate that, hey, you need to get out of here because I'm about to shoot a fireball. So that would be the direction I might go with that one. Whereas, say, I want to help the kids work on kind of finding their voice and doing some more kind of cool teamwork and advocating for each other, I might work on some more role-playing encounters. So ultimately, it doesn't matter what I'm doing so long as the goals themselves are being met. And I actually have this whole session planning system where I look at each kind of individual goal, the group goals, and figure out, okay, I want the kids to be working on this session. And then I think the best way to do this would be maybe kind of a session where they have to interview some NPCs because it's a murder mystery, or get through Dwarven TSA, which was a really fun one. Or, you know, maybe there's someone claims that they did a crime, so they have to go to court and try to proclaim their innocence. Or maybe it's just they got to go survive in the wilderness for a while and all kind of do something helpful. So they kind of recognize, hey, so-and-so is being helpful. You know, it really depends on where the group is and what I kind of see as the emergent need. And also, I'll let the kids kind of drive that a lot too. But because I'm running an applied group, there are generally specific behavioral goals that come across my desk, so to say.
So there's always the adage of, like, you know as best as you can, know the group of your players that you're playing in front of us. And so in your case, where, like you said, there's applied goals, there's goals that you want to achieve with these kids, that helps really steer your whole session prep, because it's not just, your goal isn't just to have a fun experience. Your goal is also to hit certain areas of social interaction that you're trying to reinforce or introduce or teach.
So kind of the term I use for the work I do is applied RPGs. And a lot of the time you'll hear therapeutic RPGs. I've done therapeutic RPGs. Yeah, I've worked with clinicians to DM where they're playing a PC, I'm the DM, and they're working with a specific client and their siblings at the table. But if I'm doing a educational group where I'm trying to teach, you know, this concept, that's not a therapeutic RPG. If I'm doing a social skills group, that's not a therapeutic RPG because I'm not a therapist. So I coined the idea of doing an applied RPG. And with an applied RPG versus a traditional RPG, the applied RPG, you have the goal as your true north. Yes, you want it to be fun, but everything should, in some way, reach that goal. And use every tool at your disposal to kind of move the kids towards achieving this goal. And whereas a normal RPG, you're just there to have fun.
So you mentioned therapeutic RPGs. I've heard tons of people over many years now say that RPGs are like therapy to them, or that they treat RPGs like therapy, or they're working out a fear, or they're working out an anxiety through RPGs or what have you. And I've always looked at that as a little bit like, that seems like you're playing with fire in a way. Because of the vast number of DMs I know, many of them are barely holding together. Like, they themselves feel like they're barely holding together the game session they have going on, and handling that and the personalities of however many players they have at their table. But then to try to add on the layer of being somebody's quote unquote therapist when that's not what they are, they haven't been trained for that. They may not have the background that they're just trying to be a supportive friend, but now they're kind of looped into this other thing altogether. That seems like an area that is rife for a problem. I'm not sure if you kind of share that same view of, like, making sure that there's a strong distinction between, hey, we're playing a game because it's fun and we can be together, versus I'm not qualified, maybe you should actually speak with a professional on some of these things.
It's really tricky because a lot of the times, you know, when you're role-playing, stuff can come out. And you're not even aware it's coming out. You're not even aware that you're working through this issue with this character. And I've done that by accident. You know, I have created characters that are kind of, you know, dealing with a lot of my own repressed anger. And it's coming out of this character. And on one side, it's some really good role-playing, but because it's coming from a very personal space. But on the other side, wow, my character is turning into someone who's chaotic evil. Because I'm, you know, using this as a excuse to really vent a lot of frustration to the world. So I think you have to be really cogent of what you're bringing to the table, and be able to check yourself and not take this stuff too seriously. Like, if you want to play a character who has an arc of going evil and you're just venting a lot of frustration into that, be ready for them to lose. be ready to hand your character sheet to the DM and say, I want you to play him as a villain now. I want to roll up a new character. And then also be really aware of secondary trauma. Something that I've heard in multiple cases is, like, someone will have a character that mirrors their own trauma. Anything really. And suddenly the players at the table, the DM, are just like, oh my God, this is horrible. Like, you just established that your character was just horrifically, you know, abandoned and abused, and you're really going into detail on this. And the fact that you as a 9-year-old, you know, dealt with, you know, this and blah blah. And then so the players are just like, I didn't sign up for this. And yeah, the DM's just like, I'm trying to tell a story. So you really have to be aware of what secondary trauma you can bring to the table. I think, you know, some safety tools can be really good for that. But I think there needs to be a lot more awareness of what you are bringing in. And, you know, the understanding that you're not here to work through your personal stuff. You're here to play a game with friends and for it to be fun. There can be drama and drama can be fun, but you shouldn't be bringing in all this stuff unless, you know, you've set some very clear boundaries. The understanding is that this is not therapy and that everyone at the table is comfortable with you having this really, really dark backstory. I've only seen this done well once, and it was a woman who had an abusive relation, or her mother had been abusive to her growing up, and she decided she wanted to play a drow cleric that escaped the Underdark and had this horribly abusive mom. And the players knew her and the history there. But they also knew that, oh yeah, drow cleric, of course your mom's going to be a completely abusive jerk. And that's normal and that's fine. She's a bad guy. It's okay to expect these awful things from her. So she felt that was very liberating because she got to have a happy ending where she escaped from her and was able to, like, flee the Underdark, live on the surface. I think eventually she, like, banished her mom to another plane and got to have this narrative of, I get to be a good person in spite of my abuse. And that's incredibly therapeutic. And it was done in a way where there were healthy boundaries and it made sense with the plot. And it wasn't just like, oh, I'm this person here. And also I've undergone 3 years of torture. Which really changes the tone of the game.
Yeah, I like that you bring that up, because often in the tabletop RPG space, when people talk about safety tools, there seems to be an overwhelming load of those tools being directed at, hey, DM, don't screw this up for other people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, the tools overwhelmingly seem to be at least marketed in a way that these tools are here to protect the players from an abusive DM, where it can be just as equally in place of, you know, saving, even if it's just a DM, from being uncomfortable of a player or a group of players as well. So I think it's important for players to remember that as well, is that you need to make sure that you're thinking about what you're bringing to the table as much as you may consider or worry a little bit about what might be coming back to you. You have to worry about what you're putting out equally as much. And I think that's a very important thing to mention that doesn't get maybe brought up as often as it should.
DMs are humans too.
Exactly.
And I think it's really, really important to recognize that as a DM, you are committing an act of service, but that doesn't mean people are allowed to walk all over you. And, you know, as many abusive DMs and power hungry, wannabe God DMs there are out there, I think there's a lot of DMs who need to understand that it is okay to advocate for yourself. It is okay to set boundaries. It is okay to say, I'm not okay. I'm not okay with this. This is a problem. Because one thing I've personally struggled with for a long time was a lot of the anxiety around DMing. It is a lot. It is exhausting. And sometimes you feel so kind of overwhelmed just with the load that you don't have the space to even think about how can I advocate for this? How can I advocate for myself so I feel better doing this? So I think, you know, really considering the mental health aspect, and the idea of DM burnout is really, really something we need to be doing a better job with.
With a lot of neurodivergent kids, they can get excluded from different things because maybe they are quote unquote hard to handle, or they get labeled as hyperactive. And when I was mentioning before, like my own personal understanding of that spectrum, I remember growing up, so many kids that I went to school with, these were ADHD kids, and they took different medications for those sorts of things. So there's a lot of kids that kind of get excluded, or they get grouped into this. And sometimes they are on a spectrum. Sometimes they simply are just a kid who is maybe neurotypical, but has social issues as well. How does somebody tell the difference between, or what are some things they should be on the lookout for between the difference between, let's say, a problem kid or a problem player? It doesn't need to be a kid. This could be an adult just as easily. A problem player who's being disruptive at a table versus somebody who's like, oh, we just, they're not purposely trying to be disruptive. We just need to figure out a better way of, you know, handling the whole game so that everybody's having fun with it. Like, you don't want to exclude somebody and have somebody go find out later on that you didn't know that they had a situation. And then later on you find out and you're like, oh, am I a bad person because they were disruptive and I asked them to leave. Maybe I should handle it. Like, how does somebody, I guess, approach that?
That's a really, really complicated question. And it's a really good question. And something that I think there's always, I think the best way is to focus on behaviors and focusing on setting boundaries where it's like, hey, if you do this, then this will be the consequence. So if you are, you know, disruptive and, you know, being really loud, obnoxious, and cutting people off all the time, the expectation is that everyone has an equal chance at the table, and that, you know, if you're talking 90% of the time and no one else can talk, then the expectation is that this will happen. If you're running an applied game, it becomes a bit different. If you're running a therapeutic game and you have a kid with ADHD or something who's just talking 90% of the time and everyone's getting really frustrated, well, then it's not something where you could necessarily ask the kid to leave. You would just be like, hey, let's work on this kind of behavior plan sort of thing or whatever. But I think in a non-applied game, it's just really important to focus on the player safety, make sure everyone's feeling all right, and focus specifically on behaviors. And really understand that, you know, sometimes this isn't the right table for you. There is a right table for you somewhere, but this might not be the right table for you. And that's okay. Something I'm really working on right now is building what I'm calling D&D, or like inclusive RPG groups, because such a huge thing I see in a lot of the disability scene is, you know, there will be some sort of like group or something that's made for people with disabilities, and then you don't see non-disabled people there. It's inclusion isn't happening, or if it is happening, it's not sustainable. So what I'm working on doing is finding a way to bring in people with disabilities and people without disabilities, getting them playing RPGs together, getting them understanding how to kind of navigate each other's neurodiversity, and you know, find ways to make it work, because I think everyone benefits from a situation where you have a really good understanding of how everyone at the table's brain works, how what makes them happy, how to work with them, how to support them, and how to have a really good game together. And so that is what I'm working on.
So you mentioned earlier, and I'll ask this question with this quote in mind of what you said before, where you said, if you meet one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. So with that in mind, my question will be a little bit generalized, but as best as you can. You've played obviously with groups of kids that all the players at the table are neurodivergent and are doing it through an applied way, or maybe even without an applied way, just that's the entire group. And like you just said, you're trying to find a way to do groups of mixed. And I assume you've played at tables where almost everybody wasn't, they were all neurotypical, let's say. What would you, or as neurotypical as RPG fans can be, is there massive differences that you've seen in styles of play? between those groups? Like, is there, if somebody came in and observed, they were the fly on the wall and didn't know which category that I've just arbitrarily assigned here across these three groups, would that fly on the wall be able to go, there's something different about that group, and there's something different, and oh, I've seen this group a whole bunch of times before. Like, would you notice something differently there?
You know, I at least in my experience, and this is, you know, me being the DM of these groups, so I'm kind of painting it with my own lens. I think the neurodivergent kids, again, every group is different, but they tend to throw you a lot more curveballs. So it becomes really important to get good at saying yes and or yes but. A lot of the kind of more neurotypical groups I've seen tend to be like, okay, let's do this dungeon crawl now. And that's fun. That's fine. That's absolutely awesome. But the very often the neurodivergent groups are going to really, really throw you some weird curveballs. And it also, you know, I'm queer myself, but something I've run into is playing with a group of queer people versus playing with a bunch of straight people. Straight people, it tends to look a lot like, you know, Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings. Queer people, it is very, very all over the place. Very, okay, you're playing this 9-foot-tall, super buff snake person with that's hella ripped, and then here's this like little cute pixie who is super pastel everything and is wanting to open a flower shop, and then here is this, you know, goth lord over here, and it's just very, very weird, very diverse, and I think a big part of that really comes to the norms that are set as a DM. So being able to say yes and yes but, yeah.
Do you think that's partly because, say in the neurotypical groups, there's more of, okay, this is what was put in front of us and we're going to buy into it. And it's just a buy into what was kind of presented. So like you said, oh, we're going to go into a dungeon and maybe the DM isn't running as a railroad, but the players have all went, we've picked up clearly on what this DM is setting up and we're going to play along and we'll just have fun within the bounds of what we think they've done. And maybe the neurodivergent group either don't pick up or just don't care. And there's like, no, I want to do this now. And we're just going to go over. Is that kind of the,
I think, you know, something I've found with a lot of neurodivergent players is they really don't care or can't be made to care or, you know, have been hurt by the idea of following the rules. And they have their own way of seeing the world and advocating for what they feel is important. And I think one of the best things you can do in that case is give them a sense of agency. You know, a lot of people who have been marginalized because of their neurodiversity and neurodivergence have been told no their entire lives. You know, you don't get to be yourself. You what you are is wrong. What you are is broken. And then to be able to hear, okay, yeah, you want to start your own pet shop? Let's make that happen. It's really cool. And I, again, I'm over here playing with the, I want them to throw as many curveballs as they want to the plot, because the plot isn't important. Let's get them feeling that they have a sense of control. And meanwhile, I have the ability to kind of work behind the scenes. They don't even know it's happening, but I'm kind of helping them find their voice, be comfortable around each other, and feel that what they are is okay to be.
Yes, the whole heading north, as you were saying before. If you take that to, you know, a step or two beyond that, as far as the sense of agency and the sense of yes, whatever nobody's going to tell you no up front here on this. What happens whenever you take that same kid and put them behind the DM screen and you say, here's the ropes for you? Have you done that where you've let any of these kids DM you as a player, and how has that experience been? Do they find it overwhelming? Because like we said earlier, sometimes being a DM can be overwhelming, or do they take that as like, oh, this is amazing. I can do, you know, it's a kind of like, I don't know, one of those moments where whatever I think of the world has now type idea.
So yeah, and I have my co-facilitator who is a former student, and the reason, one of the big reasons I ended up hiring her is we kind of let her guest DM a couple sessions, and she did this whole Evil Dead sort of like haunted house adventure where the kids had to go kill this gigantic, like this creepy giant heart in the basement. And there are all these like deadite creatures running around and attacking them. And it was weird. It was completely like not where we were going with the plot, but the kids had the time of their lives doing it. And she had a really good time DMing it. And, you know, she was able to really just engage with what she felt comfortable doing. And it was really successful. At the same time, sometimes it is really overwhelming for her. But what I think is really valuable is she's really good at saying, I need to go take a break. Let's come back in five. And I think there is a lot of value in being able to normalize, hey, I'm a little overwhelmed right now. So I'm, and it's totally okay to ask for space. And the kids never complain. They absolutely get it. And that shows that it is acceptable to need to take a break. And, you know, if you're realizing you're a bit dysregulated and you just need to go downstairs, get a drink of water, like be alone for a few minutes to collect your thought, that's all right.
I've said many times, even in a game where I'm assuming, and it's probably a poor assumption to make, that everybody I'm playing with is, neurotypical. But in a normal everyday game, I've had that myself where if we're playing online, I find playing games online, you get less downtime as a DM to have that moment where you consider what's happening. Often if you're playing in person and everybody's sitting around a table, you have table chatter happening. There's pauses where the players are filling time themselves that the DM can kind of sit back and consider things. Whereas I find more often when we're playing online and everybody's staring at the camera and going through things, you don't have that moment where you can kind of sit back and reflect a little bit as a DM. And I think even for people who don't, see themselves in this light, I think being able to say, hey, I need a minute, especially with online games, just so you can regroup yourself is a skill that more people need to take. I know myself, I need to take that more often. And it's, I don't know if it's simply because of the medium of it being online, but I see it happening more, at least personally myself. I feel it happening more online than I ever do at the table.
You're hitting on a really fundamental value. The things that benefit people with disabilities benefits everybody. So normalizing, realizing that, hey, I'm a little overwhelmed right now, I need a break, that benefits everyone. And I think, you know, people assume that, you know, what I call autistic social skills are somehow inferior. I disagree. You know, it's things like understanding when you're overwhelmed and need to take a break, normalizing and accepting and supporting people and recognizing like, hey, is everything okay? Do you need to take a break? Advocating for them, like, no, it's okay that he needs to take a break. Chill out. Doing things like that. And I think that, you know, it's kind of like the whole concept of universal design. And the fact that, you know, if it weren't for deaf people, we wouldn't have text messaging. Things that benefit people with disabilities benefit everybody.
It's in large part a lot of what you've said here, and what I'm hearing is simply a case of people being willing to have maybe expanding their own field of empathy a little bit more. I know that's a thing that no matter what category of person you may be speaking of, we should probably all be a little bit better at that at times. If you're a parent and you have a child who has been diagnosed or you suspect will be diagnosed, and you were say you're a parent and you grew up with RPGs and you're like, you're hearing something like this, a listener's listening to this going, that sounds like a great way for me to introduce it to my kid. I know with my son, as soon as he was able to do basic addition of stuff, we were trying to play different RPGs. Is there things that parents with kids with these needs should be watching out for more so than any other? Or how do they avoid especially when they're personally interconnected in the parent child relationship, making sure that they don't slip into this whole therapy side of things and the dangers that may come from that.
So if you're not a therapist, don't do therapy. But at the same time, being a parent, you're doing a lot of other things.
Right.
And you know, you can use RPGs as a way to teach your kids lessons or create challenging situations to build up frustration tolerance and have conversations about that and realizing that, hey, these are some areas that my kid is kind of struggling with that we could explore through games. You know, whether that's like, hey, my kid is really struggling with math, so let's have a really combat heavy campaign where they have to do math. Or my kid gets really angry and has a hard time controlling when he's angry, so let's have a really difficult campaign where, you know, he has to roll characters a lot and is able to kind of learn, hey, I'm getting angry, I'm about to throw the dice, so I need to go into the other room, punch my pillow for a while, then come back and we can go back to playing the game. And this is a really safe way where we've talked about, hey, if the game's frustrating to you, these are the things that you can do to practice this and create a really kind of safe way to practice anger management tools. And yeah, I think a lot of this stuff is just understanding, you know, the needs of your kids and being able to reach them where they are.
Yeah, I think using something that you're passionate about, whether that be RPGs or anything else, and finding a way to link it in, if whether it's for a, you know, a behavior that you're trying to model, or you mentioned math. I did when my son was really little, we had his flashcards, his reading and his math flashcards. And when he would go into combat, instead of rolling dice to see if he would hit, I would hold up a flashcard. If he could answer the flashcard, then he hit. Same thing for when an attack came back his way, I would hold up the flashcard. If he could answer it, he dodged the attack. Little things like that worked for me. I got him through all his flashcards every day, and it was yeah, fantastic. But I think
that's an applied RPG.
Yeah, I think finding those sorts of hacks and workarounds can really make things fun for both sides of it, because I'm sure it would be nowhere near as fun for either of us had we just sat down at the kitchen table and went through flashcards. This is, I think, a good way to merge an enjoyable experience and make it so it's not so much a drag. And that kind of loops into something I've noticed. So throughout all these interviews I've done over the last while, if I was to do a breakdown of the people that I'm talking to and what their background is, the overwhelming amount of people that are coming from an education background is staggering. I mean, it's got to be outside of the statistical norm of how many people that I've interviewed either are teachers or they're in academia of some sort. Why do you think there's that strong connection between RPGs and academia without there necessarily being a coordinated effort for it? It just seems like it's happening on its own.
I'm on one side, you know, classroom management and table management, very similar set of skills, you know, dealing with a bunch of out of control middle schoolers versus a table of out of control murder hobos. There's kind of some similar skills there. There is also a lot of similarities to lesson planning and session planning, kind of that similar mindset where you're creating an experience and working people through it. And then, you know, the whole academia side, you know, the RPG books are textbooks. And they fundamentally, you know, look like homework. And I think, you know, a lot of academics, just their brains are wired to do well with that. And it's kind of the same how I've heard a lot of people who are active service members really like games like 40K, because a lot of the manuals look like the manuals they have to read for the army or whatever. And so it's just kind of naturally up their alley. They kind of understand how to do this, and it's very easy for them to slide into that role. I think with DMing and teaching, that's such a similar way of presenting an experience that it just naturally matches up pretty easily.
I've got three more questions for you. Okay. The first one is different groups seem to really enjoy, you've got some groups that are very visually stimulated where they want to see really fancy maps and their character art and things that way. You've got other groups that are more tactile based where they want figurines to fiddle with or to fidget with, or to have terrain and everything built up that way, and that really helps them visualize what's happening in the game. There's other folks that do everything theater of the mind and barely roll dice most of the game. Is there with the neurodivergent groups? Is there groups where you're like, okay, this group is going to be, I know that some of these kids are, they need to have something tactile in order to engage with this game properly. Does that become a bigger consideration whenever you're planning out a game for these groups of kids than say somebody who's just planning a normal everyday game?
Well, and I think I have to look at myself and my own skill set. I have, you know, some slight fine motor issues. So I'm where miniatures go to be defaced. My paint.
Spray paint a solid color and put them out.
Pretty much, and it's kind of painful, but I really focus on the theater of mind stuff, and I think my players have come to expect that. And you know, I lean into my own strengths. If I were really into minis, I figure I could probably find a really good way to teach social skills for minis. Or the visual stuff, I'm sure I could do that. As far as, you know, talking about tactile needs and stuff, you know, talking to kids about what helps center them, a lot of the times kids will bring like fidget spinners or things like that, or dice towers is a big thing. You always have to be very careful with those because noise sensitive kids can get really overwhelmed when the minute it falls over. So you have to make sure it's done on a soft surface. But really kind of figuring out, you know, where the kids' needs and skill sets and, you know, what they're all about matches what you're all about, and then kind of being able to figure out all those Venn diagrams, stretch a little bit in this direction, stretch a little bit in that direction. But, you know, it's all about stretching and compromising and then setting boundaries in the work you do.
So kind of on the same vein, some people say that D&D can be played for any sort of genre or any sort of game type, and I agree it technically can, but I don't think that makes it good for every type of genre and every type of game system. What sort of game systems do you typically play with the kids? And do you have your own, you must have your own preferences for which ones you prefer more, but is there ones that you find you've had greater success over others? Or
I use D&D just because it's the Windows. You know, there's other systems I'd like to do. I wrote my own system. It's called The Caravan Endures. And it is very much a narrative heavy, thematically, it's like a trucker simulator set in the D&D universe with some Western flair. You know, there's cowboy hats and stuff. And that was one I really enjoyed writing. But at the same time, most of the time I'm getting paid, or the expectation is I'm going to be running D&D because that's what Windows is. That may change with the OGL drama, and I welcome that because honestly, with the type of games I run, they're so theater mind heavy, it doesn't make sense to be like, hey, so you're all going to be running a theme park and it's going to be cool and you're going to have to deal with all these different groups of customers. Oh, and here's your character sheet. It looks like a tax form and it shows you all the 12 ways you can murder people. And they're like, wait, I thought I was director of concessions. Why do I have a sword and the ability to throw acid at people? It's like, well, it is what it is. But, you know, I think a lot of it's just setting that culture. And one of the things I'm really, really hoping, you know, with the OGL stuff is people start rethinking the idea of that violence is necessary. To telling a meaningful story, because I'm a pacifist. I really don't like guns. I don't like war. I've had way too many experiences, you know, working in crisis and you know, living in a neighborhood with a lot of crime, where I have had close encounters with gunfire and guns and people pulling them, and you know, I've seen my share of violence enough to just absolutely hate it. And I think there's so many more beautiful stories that don't need people to die to make them happen.
I've always found it's interesting that I'll encounter people like yourself that kind of have that opinion where, like, you know, combat's not what we want to focus on. but then they play 5e. Yeah. And 5e is the entire game is built around combat. People will argue differently, but if you look at a character sheet, 99% of everything on that character sheet and all the class abilities and everything else is based around combat. Whereas when I flip it back to the games I prefer, like original D&D and BX D&D, combat is definitely there, but there is a much higher emphasis on being clever, finding a way to avoid getting into combat, because the power scale is so different and your character is so much more likely to die if you enter combat, as opposed to the newer editions of D&D where it's very difficult for a character to die a lot of the times. I find that the players tend to try to, if we're going to combat, we're going in with overwhelming force, but most of the time, no, that's going to kill us. Let's find a different way to get around it. And I wish that kind of message got out more to people who may not be aware. They may not have ever heard, they may just be like, well, D&D, I'm going to go with the latest version because that's what there is. But I think there is definitely different styles of play through them all. And it would be, I'd really like to see that style of rewarding the clever player that finds a way to avoid a combat situation be more put forward.
The combat that I do so much theater of the mind stuff where it's a lot of like mysteries. Hey, there's this lich who's somewhere out there and he's building an evil theme park. I do theme parks a lot. It's called Gore World. It's like Willy Wonka if he is really into torture, and you have to find him and destroy his theme park. And you know, very little combat, and just all theater of the mind. So I really kind of focus on that. When I do combat, there are kids that, come in, they want to play D&D, they want combat. And what I found is a really, really good way to make that happen is the WWE pro wrestling.
Put them in an arena.
Oh, yeah. And I've had kids that are really into the combat thing. And so I'll give the characters different jobs. Like one will be the announcer, one will be the ref, two of them will be wrestlers. And what's really cool is, the kids that are really into combat stuff, they're also doing a whole speech about, they're coming to the ring and be like, I am the Hellraiser and I'm going to drag all of your souls to the abyss. And, doing all that bit. And then, when it comes to the actual combat stuff, they're like, okay, can I do another speech? I'm like, yes, you can do another speech. And it's wonderful. It's just nice.
So we were chatting before we started talking here, before we hit the record button, and you were saying that recently things have kind of been blowing up for you in terms of, a lot more people being interested in what you're doing and talking about that. So you've been talking with a bunch of people. Like we said, I kind of found you from the U of W blog and podcast that they had. Of all these different interviews that you've done or all these different people that you've talked to over the last little while of all of this, and people are asking questions and trying to get better informed, is there something that somebody should have asked, but they haven't yet? Is there a question where you're like, every time you sit down, you're like, man, I hope somebody asks me about this so I can go on about it. Or after you get off, after the interview is over, you're like, I really wanted to bring this up, but I didn't get a chance to. So my last question before we start wrapping up is, what should I have asked you that I have not asked you yet? Or what is something that you wish somebody else had asked previously that you wanted to kind of expand on a little bit more that you need the airtime to do so?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think one of the things I'm the most passionate about right now is the idea that within the applied gaming world, anybody can do this. Anybody can do good with games. That doesn't mean you need to go try to be a DM therapist and go to grad school and get your therapeutic licensure. No. Find a way where you can do good with games and understand that doing some basic good with games doesn't mean you're doing therapeutic gaming. Helping kids make friends, helping, kind of at-risk kids that might be getting into some other, stuff or have a hard time finding a healthy community, doing that. That's something that anyone can do. And right now, I think the world is dealing with so much. There are so many kids who are really kind of reeling after, you know, a year of isolation still, and a lot of stress. And I think the world needs so many more, you know, DMs that are willing just to jump in, run games at your local library. I know a lot of libraries are, well, prior to COVID, were setting up D&D groups where community members could partner with the library and run groups like that. I think that's a great idea. Partnering with your Boys and Girls Club, partnering, with your local YMCA. Find ways to do good with games. Everybody has some special thing that they can do that'll make a game special and really change a kid's life or adult. You know, I know people that have run games in homeless shelters, and we need more of that too. So just do good with games.
I think that's a pretty awesome message, actually. The one thing you mentioned in there is library. Also a huge shout out to libraries. I don't know what happened in the last like 25 years that collectively the universe seems to have forgotten that libraries exist. But if you have not been to your local library, go, people, because there's so many cool things that most of these libraries do. I'm fortunate enough that I live close to a few different major metros, and the libraries, the options that are available to you there, from everything from 3D printing to maker spaces to the Toronto Public Library, which is I'm not super close to, but fairly close to. They've got an entire music floor, and you can go play instruments. Go to your public library. There's so many cool things there. Public libraries do not get enough love, and they deserve it. So go check it out for clubs and everything else as well. But it's an amazing building. Go see it again if you haven't been in a long while.
I am slightly jealous. You know, a lot of the in America, a lot of libraries are getting shut down due to funding cuts. Which is really tragic. But at the same time, the libraries that are able to stay open, they are run by the most passionate, nerdy, kind people you will ever meet. They know everything. They're probably some of the smartest people you'll ever meet. And they just want to make a wonderful space for you.
You mentioned that you wrote your own game, Caravan Duras.
Yeah.
Is there a place that people can go and find that? Is it like on DriveThruRPG or anything like that?
It's currently up on Itch. If you go to my website, rollforkindness.com, there's a link or a post about that. And then later a post about how me kind of reminiscing on how I did not make the money I spent on it back and kind of being a little upset about that. which it's on me. I'm one of my experiences, you know, after my diagnosis is realizing I don't know any of the rules to socialization or even existing. And one of the things I realized after the fact is I should have looked at all these people that were doing Kickstarters, because I've got a lot of kind of colleagues and peers that funded their game through Kickstarter, whereas I paid about $2,000 on all the art for the game. And I've made maybe $250 back. And, you know, it's fine. It is what it is. I also released it for free initially, pay what you want, and that was a mistake. But I also wanted it to be accessible for whoever needed it. And, you know, it's a game that is very much doing its own thing. And I think the idea that, hey, the whole point of this game is you're not a knight, you're not a soldier, you're not a fighter at all. You're just someone running a caravan. That's kind of a hard sell for a lot of people.
If you're interested and you have the time, I know you're very busy with things going on. By the time this one airs, there'll be two episodes ago. So episode 123 of my podcast, I had a gentleman come on, and we went through the entire process of going through a Kickstarter and the things to consider and the thought process he went through and trying to make sure that it was financially satisfying as well as creatively satisfying for him. So it was an interesting conversation. It might be one that you're interested in.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I agree. The finding the niche group, the niche within the niche within the niche, right? Because let's be honest, tabletop role-playing games is a niche hobby. And then as you go further down that niche and away from the Microsoft Windows or the Kleenex brand of that mm-hmm. hobby, the smaller and smaller that pie gets. But running a caravan, I have not seen the game, so I don't know all the details on it, but running a caravan, to me, I instantly think of Oregon Trail and all
very much Oregon Trail. Yeah.
The fun times of planning out an expedition like that. I think you could do some really cool stuff with that in a role-playing game.
It's Oregon Trail without a lot of the weird colonialist stuff. Yes, it has all the visual, you know, covered wagons, people with cowboy hats, but also chainmail and radar dishes. It's very kind of anachronistic and weird. But I do have, you know, some other kind of games that are kind of on the horizon. So I'm eventually looking at branching out, but I think right now my focus is so much on the idea of how can we make games more fundamentally accessible and inclusive for the disability community. That is taking a lot of my bandwidth, and it's an area I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, I can tell, and I think it's a fantastic service you're bringing both the kid. For me, I look at it definitely more on the kids' side, because that's kind of a passion of mine, is making sure that the kids are getting different experiences and having a really fun time. But equally as important, like you said, for adults who are maybe just finding out about this, or they've known about it for a while, but they didn't have an outlet for it. So I think the whole applied gaming in that sense is really, really interesting. Peter, where can people find you if they want to ask more questions, or if they want to find out more about all this? Where should they go to look? Is there a key touch point that they should go to contact you from?
So kind of the way I'm most responsive with for now, and this is assuming it doesn't burn, is Twitter. I'm Roll for Kindness there. That's R-O-L-L-F-O-R, Kindness. And then also rollforkindness.com. And I, again, Twitter might crash and burn, in which case I will post whatever the best way to reach out to me after Twitter is. We'll see where things go from there. But I post a lot of the work I do on rollforkindness.com, and I'm very excited about more articles about how we can kind of make the world a better place for everyone using RPGs.
That's awesome. If you get a chance, check out. I know with the last 2 months of life with Twitter, people have been scattering all over the place. If you get a chance, check out Mastodon, though. There is a lot of really cool communities. Depending on which server you join up on, you can talk to all the servers. I'm not sure how much you know about Mastodon, but
it's not
as segmented as people make it out to be, but it is definitely, you can find a server that has a community already built similar to what you may or may not be interested in.
I have a Mastodon. It's one of those things where I've done a little bit with it. I've worked so hard to get like 1600 followers, and the idea of jumping to something where it's like 20 followers is like
True. I could understand that. I think the difference is a change in mindset of it's not a numbers game on that platform. So, if all else fails, rollforkindness.com they can find you at, and as the social media landscape changes and evolves, we'll all have you along on the ride for that one, I think.
Yep.
All right, well, thank you very much. I'm going to pass this up to Future Me to do some editing, and then we'll come back from that. But thank you again very so much for coming onto the show and having a chat with me. I learned a lot, and hopefully everybody who was listening also did as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay, folks, that's going to wrap up this episode of the Red Caps Podcast. I hope you enjoyed, you learned something, and that you are eager to come back for more. www.theredcaps.net has all the links to all the ways to reach me, and I would love to talk to you. Thank you very so much for listening, and remember, never let your caps dry out. Stay safe, have fun. We'll talk again soon.